This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. It is that time of year when we take a look back at the best and favorite shows of the year. And I'm joined by one of our producers, Dana Terry. In addition to news and culture, many of our sports stories come from her. So anytime you hear a story about superheroes, she probably pitched it, and she is passionate about criminal justice as well as all of our producers are, interested in lots and lots of things, but obviously certain specialties. She joins us now with her picks. And Dana, if you had one pick that was really a hit for you in 2019, what was it?
It was a story that I was sort of personally witnessed. You remember last Christmas, you gave us gift certificates to this fancy schmancy restaurant in Hillsboro. Mm-hmm. I finally get the opportunity to do it. It's a big birthday, and we're driving through, you know, Hillsboro. And I look and I see this man at a stoplight, and he's got on a robe. And I just assume, oh, it's a Catholic church. No, as I pan up, I see the pointy hat, and it was the Klan on full display in downtown Hillsboro. And so, you know, I came back. I had to tell you guys the story. Of course, by then it was all over the news, and then we had to talk about it, Frank.
Well, we did, and we talked to LaTondra Strong, who is a resident of Hillsboro and the co-founder of Hate Free Schools Coalition, and she was one of the first to encounter the protesters at the rally. Let's listen to some of that conversation.
I had heard that this element exists in our community, that there were people in Orange County who have robes in their closets. But in my 50 years of living, I had thought that this was a thing of the past. And so as I'm approaching them, I'm thinking, what am I going to say? And, you know, am I going to risk my safety? And it just felt important for me to stand up, and in particular as a woman of color, to let them know that this is a different time and that we are not going to accept this behavior, and that as a community, we will collectively stand against this behavior.
What happened in that encounter?
Well, I did a live stream. HPTA had a alert system already employed. So within minutes, people started gathering, and we started making the Klan feel uncomfortable. And before you know it, members of the community actually crossed the street and stood in front of them, which was alarming because many of them had guns.
Yeah.
So they were armed.
Yeah. No.
So this was clearly not a safe situation, but it is also not safe to make this the norm in your community. And I think the people of Hillsboro said, no, this won't happen here.
And you didn't leave it at that. You decided then to plan a rally.
Yes.
After that.
So as the Klan was leaving, they said, we'll be back next week. And so with the full awareness of knowing that we could potentially come against this Klan again, we decided that we would organize a march. And when I did that permit on the Monday after facing the Klan, my expectation would be that it would be 200 people that would show up. And as you now know, there was closer to 1,000.
As LaTondra Strong, co-founder of Hate Free Schools Coalition, a Hillsboro resident, sharing her experience dealing with hate in the community this year. And I'm talking with State of Things producer Dana Terry. And of course, in 2018, you covered student walkouts and did a great job finding students for us who could articulate their concerns about school safety. So this past year, you wanted to highlight the voices of young climate activists, right?
Yeah, you would have thought these young ladies were in college, but they were high school age. Greta Thunberg, she started a movement where each Friday, youth climate activists would skip class and protest. So we talked to Mary Ellis Stevens, a high school freshman in Charlotte who had been striking every Friday. We also talked to Hallie Turner, a high school senior in the Triangle, who is suing the state over climate change. They both talked about their fight to be heard.
I was first inspired by Al Gore's book, A Kid's Version of an Inconvenient Truth, and I read that and I was shocked by the magnitude of the crisis, but also by how little I felt people were talking about it and how it was communities that were often poor communities and communities of color that were contributing the least to the climate crisis but being affected the most by it.
And of course, Greta Thunberg, Mary Ellis, tell us about her, the young Swedish activist who got worldwide attention for the action she took. Tell us more about her, Mary Ellis.
So Greta Thunberg is 16, and August of last year, she decided that instead of going to school, she was going to sit outside the Swedish parliament and demand climate action. And she was recently nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, and if she wins, she'll be the youngest person ever, which is super cool. and she just finished a 2-week voyage across the Atlantic in a sailboat that was a zero carbon emissions sailboat to attend the UN Climate Summit in New York.
Hallie, tell us more about your involvement in fourth grade. I mean, you said a mouthful there. You talked about minority communities. Those least involved are the most affected, or the least culpable are the most affected. And this is all things that you were becoming aware of in fourth grade. How did you learn all that?
So when I first figured out about the climate crisis at the library, I immediately wanted to do more research online. And I basically just used Google and was finding out everything that I could. And then I have learned about it in school since then, but
What about it in fourth grade? Because you could have a lot on your mind in fourth grade, other than what's happening in communities that may or may not be yours.
What scares me the most about the climate crisis is that it's my generation, the young people of today, that are being the most impacted by it and have to deal with the decisions that leaders make today about our futures. So I think that's what struck me even in fourth grade, was that it was my generation that's going to be at stake here.
Mary Ellis, assuming that something like that is true for you as well, that your generation is affected, what happens when you talk with other people, your peers, about this? Do they feel the urgency of this generally, or what kind of conversations are you having?
Definitely. I think a large majority of the people that I talk to that are my age are really worried about this, and they do recognize the magnitude of this issue. And a lot of my friends have expressed interest in taking action, whether through the strikes or through other forms of direct action. But yeah, we're all pretty anxious for our futures because it is going to be devastating.
What about what other forms of action, and how do those conversations go? Because as I suggested when I introduced this segment, a lot of people feel paralyzed. This is way over our heads. It's too much. It's too complicated. There are too many factors involved outside of our control, and a sense that any action I might take might not be enough. I'm sure that's been part of your conversation. And if it has, where does it go from there? I'll stick with you for a minute, Mary Ellis.
That's definitely part of the conversation. There is kind of a feeling of hopelessness, but I refuse to accept it. And so I recognize that as an individual, there's not a ton that I can do, but I'm going to do every single thing that I can. And so a lot of my friends who've been interested in taking action, they're like, what's something I can do that's going to actively make a difference? And what I always tell people is just talk about it as much as you can. If someone mentions the weather, you know, roll that into the fact that storms are worsening, and just talk about it as much as possible, because the more that we talk about it, the more people realize how urgent this is. So that's one of the things that I really like to tell people to do.
That was Mary Ellis Stevens, a freshman at Myers Park High School in Charlotte and director of Earth Uprising Charlotte and vice president of North Carolina Climate Strike. And with her, Hallie Turner, a senior at Enloe High School in Raleigh, who petitioned the state to protect North Carolina's climate system. And I am here with State of Things producer Dana Terry, talking about her favorite segments of 2019. Of course, we did some specials this past year. Which one was your favorite?
You know, I'm sure that tomorrow Amanda is going to say the same thing, but I absolutely love our Wall Street, our Black Wall Street special that we did live from Full Frame. What do you think about that?
Well,
experience?
It was the 150th anniversary of the city of Durham. And I tell you, I've been living here now for, I don't know, close to 20 years or something. And every minute I find something new about this city that just dazzles me. So talking about the history of Durham is something that I love to do.
It was great to put that piece together and then to have the community involved and to be able to witness it. But I would say my second favorite piece was when you're not here. You know, Frank, when you leave, we always cut up. And so Anita did an embodied special. The topic was aging and intimacy. We found a woman in Greensboro, Ellen Ashley, who was newly divorced at 60, and she decided to start internet dating. Here's a little bit of her story.
I was on Match, and I tried Tinder, and I tried OkCupid. And so, you know, Tinder is the scary one for everybody because they say it's a hookup site. And of course, my friend Judy in Boston, who is in the Northeast, she says, oh my gosh, that's the best one, but it's not a hookup site. But honestly, there, you know, you put no personal information into Tinder except a photo, pretty much. So yeah, it's a hookup site, pretty much.
Well, what was but, it like to build a profile of yourself as someone who hadn't been in the dating world for 20 some years to now kind of create this online persona for other people to see? What was that like for you?
It was a challenge. You know, I redid my profile several times. I found that you really do need professional photos. And because the first thing, especially for guys, sorry, but I mean, they're very visually oriented. They don't really care if you're the best cook, the best dancer, that, you know, all this. You know, if you don't look good to them, they're not even going to reply to you on a match dating site. So photos are very important.
So you hadn't experienced intimacy or sexual intimacy, I guess, in a particular way for a long time. What was it like to renegotiate that once you were out in the dating world again?
It was a huge challenge. Physically, I went to my gynecologist and said, I need help just physically getting things working again, you know, because, you know, your body atrophies when you don't exercise. Well, guess what? Your other parts of your body atrophy, too. So there was that. Yeah. And then you were really careful who you were meeting up with, because if you weren't with a very, very considerate man or woman, you know, that it wasn't going to be fun for you anyway.
That was Greensboro resident Ellen Ashley, part of an Embodied special on intimacy and aging hosted by Anita Rao. I'm talking with State of Things producer Dana Terry about her favorite segments of 2019. And Dana, I understand that she found herself a nice guy to date, right?
Yeah, that's kinda great. Sure did. It was touching. We got a lot of positive response from that particular show.
All right, Dana, stay right there because we're coming back and I want to talk to you some more about your favorites from 2019. And I'm guessing at least one of them is going to have to do with crime, justice, or an unsolved murder. Stay tuned to find out. To the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and I'm talking with producer Dana Terry. And one of the things that people probably don't realize is how seriously we take diversity and inclusion. At the end of each week, we take a look at the week gone by, we tally things up, and we see how inclusive we were. We take a look at certainly racial, ethnic, religious, age diversity, as well as topics. So we spend a fair amount of time on Friday going back over the numbers. Huh?
It makes things harder, Frank. But it's great because what happens is it challenges us. If we want to do a story about science or NASA, we automatically think of older white male. This rule challenges us to go find a Katie Mack, an astrophysicist, you know, who is female. And so this is the way that we, you know, look at ways of being more inclusive, but it also gives us permission to tell stories that make people uncomfortable. This year, I did a story. I mean, North Carolina has a difficult relationship with trans and the whole bathroom bill. This year, I did a story on a trans athlete who was headed to a Division I Ivy League education with a scholarship and then decided to transition to male. We talked to Skylar Baylor. Let's listen.
I was recruited in September of 2013. That's the fall of my senior year. And that whole year, I was really, really struggling with my mental health. So despite getting recruited to Harvard, I wasn't happy at all. And I always kind of explained that time was very confusing to me. I was very lost. I was miserable. And I kind of held on by my teeth to my swim career. And by the end of that year, I actually ended up deciding to take a gap year. I had no idea about my identity at the time. I just knew that I was really, really spiraling downwards with mental health. So I took a gap year. I went to a mental health treatment center actually for an eating disorder, which was what I was struggling with the most. And I spent 131 days at this center. And it was there that I was really able to find the space to describe my identity and to really introspect about my identity. And that's where I finally said to myself and to others that I'm transgender.
Tell me how that came about. What was happening that allowed you to identify this gender conflict as the source of your difficulties?
Sure. So the first thing is I think that there were sort of seeds to that my whole life, you know, but I was so focused on swimming and school and sort of finding you know, theoretical excellence in both that I didn't ever take the time to think about myself. And I, you know, that's a thing that I think is a fault of many school systems, that they don't teach you to invest in emotions, invest in learning about your emotions, and invest in learning about your own identity as much as they do about, you know, academic achievements. So that's the first factor. The second thing is I was doing a lot of therapy. I had a fantastic therapist who pushed me to talk about things that were hard for me, which is, you know, sort of where the game is. And I, you know, I actually ended up meeting another trans person in treatment as well. And that changed my life. You know, that was the first time in my entire life I was able to see myself in someone else and see my identity mirrored in somebody else. And I spent that whole day crying because it was so overwhelming to me emotionally. But like I said, it absolutely changed my life, and it showed me that there was more of a possibility for me to be myself.
That was a little bit of our interview with Skylar Baylor, a trans athlete on the Harvard swim team, one of Dana Terry's favorites from this year. What stood out for you in that interview?
I used to work at SiriusXM when it first launched, and so I've done a lot of LGBTQ stories. I have not heard anyone able to articulate trans the way Skylar did. It was such an important moment to me as a producer, as a person, as a North Carolinian, to hear these stories being told in this way, because people need to understand what it is that we're talking about. This isn't about a bathroom bill. This is about a human being, and here that human being is.
It's good stuff, and it's what we do. And again, getting back to, you know, taking a look back at diversity every week, you know, making sure that we're talking not only in terms of gender and race, but is there enough variety in our topics to, you know, make it worth getting out there every day? And are we serving our audience? And this is the kind of thing that really holds our feet to the fire. So it's the kind of product that I think we produce as a result. You also spoke with Jacob Tobia, who grew up in the Triangle, and talked about being gender nonconforming.
What I won't say is that being gender nonconforming and very visibly gender nonconforming in the world is always easy. There are moments when it's beautiful. I mean, even just walking to the studio here, I'm recording in New York. I'm sad I couldn't be with you in Raleigh. But I, you know, walking to the studio, I walk by this woman and she takes one look at me and my pink lipstick and my cute little like 70s vintage inspired hot pink look. And, you know, just a big smile broke out on her face, you know, and there was such warmth and kindness just emanating from her. And it was a gorgeous experience. And then 2 seconds later, I walk by another person on the street and this guy looks at me like, what are you doing? Who are you? You like freak? Why are you on the street? You know, and so there's this incredible polarity with how I navigate the world. And my hope for both this book and for the world more generally is that we can ultimately build towards a world where that polarity is decreased and consolidated into the positive and the beautiful.
And
because I want to live in a world where we all just celebrate everyone's gender.
Well, and you make an effort to engage it. You can tell the story that you write in the book, Sissy, A Coming of Gender Story, about being at Duke University and at the marketplace, having a little lunch and the table full of football players. And then you write an email. So maybe you can tell the story about what happened and the fact that you chose to follow up.
Yeah, well, it's funny because it was so typical what happened, you know, and I like to live a life that is atypical, or I like to live a life that is at least narratively different than what you expect. But every now and then the world just serves you something that's straight out of a movie. And this was certainly one of those moments. It was the first time in my adult life that I'd put on lipstick of my own volition, you know, like went and bought it at the Dollar General in Durham off of East Campus. And, you know, put some on and went to the dining hall. And then as I, you know, had my tray of food, I walked past a table full of football players. And one of them scooted out in front of me and just, you know, kind of like leaned really low in his chair and very threateningly said, "You got something on your lips." And I just, you know, for a second, I didn't even process that I was being, you know, like bullied or heckled or whatever. And then, you know, everyone at the table was kind of like laughing or whatever. And I just kind of walked around. I said something like, you know, yeah, I'm wearing lipstick, and then just kind of walked around the table. But then as I sat with the incident, I really thought about, like, what does it mean culturally that I'm at a school where, because someone's in the athletics program and the athletics program has power, they feel that they're able to put me down, that they have the right to to bully me and to harass me publicly. I mean, it's a really big room that that he did this in. It was very like a high school movie kind of thing, except it was college. And then, you know, I sent an email to some administrators and to the coaches of the football program saying this happened and it's not acceptable, and waited around for some kind of follow up. And they're just, you know, I got a sort of sketchy, half apologetic call from an assistant coach, you know, out of the blue with no warning, no chance to prep, not an in-person meeting, nothing, where he just assured me like, oh, it's been handled. And I was kind of like, well, how? And he was just like, well, it's been handled. You know, we do a training about this. As if that was enough, as if that had worked. And, you know, in the end, I actually felt worse for speaking up, because the only thing worse than speaking up against something bad that happens is speaking up and then nothing happening. You know, it makes you feel very powerless.
But you do speak up and you speak out. You've written this book. You're in Hollywood making it as a producer and a performer. One of your introductions to the small screen was the MTV show True Life. And I actually want to play a clip from True Life now to give us a sense of that. And then we'll talk more about it.
In this episode of True Life, you'll meet two young people pushing the boundaries of gender simply by being themselves.
The dress that I'm wearing today is beautiful.
Jacob lives out and proud in New York, where they turn heads by looking fabulous in a dress and a beard.
That's a clip from the MTV reality series True Life. That's 2015 episode. What's happening there? Because there is more of this in media. You're participating in it. Are things beginning to change?
Yeah, I have great hope for the future and for where things are going, because I know that I'm part of an entire generation that sees gender fundamentally differently, and has a level of just chill about the whole thing. You know, and I think that's such an important aspect to this, is that I don't want a world where everyone has to worry about gender all the time, where gender has to be some serious thing. A free world, a world free from patriarchy, a world without misogyny, a world where trans people belong, is a world where every day feels like dress up, because that's what we're doing every day anyway.
That's a clip of Jacob Tobiap, the author of the book Sissy, A Coming of Gender Story, and I'm talking about that with producer Dana Terry, one of her favorite segments of 2019. So tell us more about that one.
Frank, I think the hardest part of this piece was the title of the book, Sissy. It made me so uncomfortable. I mean, I don't know what that word feels like to someone who is in the LGBTQ community, but it felt a lot like the N-word to me. It's like, ew, this is very uncomfortable, but that's the title he chose, and probably to evoke certain kinds of emotions.
It's one of the things, you've been in the communications business long enough, you're at these threshold or these liminal moments in cultural development, right, where a group that has been a minority that has been oppressed for any length of time will begin to reappropriate what had been epithets.
Right.
So if you're in the business long enough, you're hearing people who used to cringe at that word now using the word,
right,
and you vaguely have permission, but it is awfully awkward to say, okay, now can I say that? Well, let's turn now to another conversation, a clip from our interview with Itaf Rum, who wrote the novel A Woman Is No Man, hoping to shine light on the lesser-known aspects of life for Palestinian-American women. Let's hear a bit of her story. We'll come back and talk about it.
I was raised in a very one-dimensional household, very conservative, and so I knew that ultimately the only way to get married was through an arranged marriage. Mm-hmm. The idea of falling in love was something foreign to me. And so the arranged marriage was not odd. It was normal in my eyes. And it was only after a few years in the marriage, after pursuing an education and then another education and another education, that I slowly began to understand the limits of how far I could go in this culture, and that there would always be a glass ceiling above me, as educated as I wanted to be, regardless of my career. And so it took a few years for me to realize that I really needed to break away in order to become who I wanted to be.
Why was that true, do you think? The fact that there was no amount of education, right, and accomplishment within this culture that could allow you to break free?
And I'd like to say within the specific family that I came from, right? Because in the culture, there's it's a spectrum. Sure. So there are some very conservative families and some that are very liberal. And so in this very conservative community where I came from, regardless of how much education I had, I was still a woman.
Yeah.
And the husband was the king of the house, the king of the family. He makes all the decisions. He earns the money. I am still under his power, and I can only achieve as much as I can achieve as long as I am beneath him and his rule. And so my education, even though it had gotten me a career, I was still beholden to this idea that family comes first, motherhood comes first, your duties as a wife come first, and your husband is the number one priority. And that didn't really sit well with me.
And as you say, you had a career, but it was not writing. So when did the idea for A Woman Is No Man come to you?
So I was teaching literature and English composition at Nash Community College in Rocky Mount. And I've been teaching there for about 4 to 4 or 5 years. And during that last year, I was teaching literature and I realized that stories of Arab American women like me are not present in bookshelves or in literature or in libraries. It was really rare to find our stories represented. And I wanted to change that. I wanted to write a story about what it means to be not just an immigrant in America, but an Arab American immigrant in America, what it means to be a woman, an Arab American woman. And so I think that was the main drive, the main purpose that I had to write the story was not just to represent these women who are suffering through some sort of injustice in a patriarchal society, but also to give all women a voice.
That's a clip from author Itaf Rum sharing the real-life experiences that inspired her to write the book A Woman Is No Man. And that conversation was one of producer Dana Terry's favorites of the year. She's with me now to talk about them. What'd you like about that?
I don't know her story. That's what I liked about it. I don't pick a lot of novels. This was a first-time novel. She's a professor, but she wanted to tell her story. And I think it's important. When I left North Carolina the first time, there were Black people and there were white people and there were Native people on reservations. And that's what I grew up in. And the world has changed. And we need to understand some of those stories, too.
Well, I know criminal justice and crime and unsolved crimes also on your radar and things that keep you excited around here. What draws you to these stories?
I don't know. I've observed that the justice system works for the people who can afford to work it. So whenever I see the underdog story, whenever I see someone who wasn't supposed to win in court win, whenever there's something where justice isn't served or anybody who's been exonerated, I absolutely love these cases. And one that stood out for me this year was the documentary on Lennon Lacy. It was at Full Frame this year. And it's about the lynching of Lennon Lacy. The cops called it a suicide. The family called it a lynching. And here's our clip from the filmmaker Jacqueline Olive.
Lennon was found hanging in Bladenboro, North Carolina. He was found hanging from a swing set on August 29th, 2014. And I reached out to his mother, Claudia, and spoke with his older brother, Pierre, to get more details. And the more that I talked with them, the more that I realized there were so many parallels to what had been going on historically in communities that were dealing with the fallout of historical lynchings. And so one of the inconsistencies in the evidence is that they believe that the shoes that were found on Lennon's feet were not his. They were a size 10 and a half, and Lennon wore a size 12. And so there are inconsistencies in the evidence. There's the fact that he was dating a, at the time, 31-year-old white woman in a town with sharp racial divisions, a small town of 1,700 people. Bladenboro is also small in, you know, in, by definition of small towns, it's extraordinarily small. And also it is geographically isolated. And so is a town in which these kind of stories, these kind of cases could be easily overlooked. And so I really wanted to understand more about what happened and to really look at that case in depth.
And the fact that, you know, and there's also a history of the Bladenboro police who had been involved in a horrific scandal involving drug sales and extortion of black black men in the town. All of this adds up to a lot of suspicion. Talk about how the story unfolds in Bladenboro and how these communities are handling it at the time.
Like lynchings historically, there was a very swift investigation and very cursory. And so within 3 days, the police came to Claudia and Pierre and told them that Lennon committed suicide. And Claudia did not believe that her son committed suicide. She doesn't know what happened, but she wants answers, and she wanted answers. And so she worked with the North Carolina NAACP, with Reverend William Barber, to get an FBI investigation opened into the case. And so we follow that journey. Ultimately, the FBI did open an investigation into the case. That's actually quite unusual. It's quite unusual in the context of the spate of hangings that have been going on since 2005 of black people found hanging contemporarily in public spaces from trees. Heather Radelaide, who is the attorney who helped to bring the evidence to the FBI for the Lacey family, Heather found that there were 20 similar hangings of black people across the country from 2005 to 2016. And it's still continuing. There was the hanging of Otis Byrd in my home state of Mississippi in 2015, and Ben Kada, who was found hanging, a Muslim teenager, 18, who was found hanging outside of Seattle, Washington, from a tree in 2017.
That's writer, director, and producer Jacqueline Olive talking about the lynching of Lennon Lacey, a 17-year-old found hanging from a swing set in Bladenboro, North Carolina, one of Dana Terry's favorites from 2019.
Jacqueline had been studying lynching for years, and then this Lennon Lacey story came up, and it sort of rounded out this documentary that she had been working on. It's called Always in Season. It won a special jury award for moral urgency at Sundance. A big deal. And now a national audience knows the story of Lennon Lacey and the history of lynching in America. And it holds Bladenboro's feet to the fire. I mean, it's out there now. You know, what are you going to do about it?
We'll talk about more of the conversations on the state of things and some of Dana Terry's favorites when our program continues on the state of things. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and each year I get together with our producers and talk about the biggest and most important stories of the year for them. But the State of Things is also about the art and culture of North Carolina, so it's not just news. Each Friday, we feature a local band, and we don't discriminate around here in terms of genre: rock, rap, country, blues, jazz, and even gospel. And Dana Terry has some ideas about music, don't you, Dana?
Right, you have to understand, when Fox decided to do Grease Live, I pulled a poodle skirt out of my closet. I have one.
I know, you wore it here.
A pink turtleneck, and I was, you know, doing Grease, ram-a-lam-a-lama. I was having a ball. So the idea of bringing different sorts of music really appealed to me. So when I got a call that Raleigh Little Theater was doing the West Side Story Symphony Concert, they had to come by and perform for us.
Tonight, tonight, the world is full of light, with suns and moons all over the place. Tonight, tonight, the world is wild and bright, going mad, shooting sparks into space. Today, the world was just an dress, a place for me to live in, no better than all right. But here you are, and what was just a world is a star tonight. Tonight, tonight, it all began tonight. I saw you and the world went away.
I cannot stay. Go quickly.
I'm not afraid.
They are strict with me, please.
I love you.
Yes, yes, hurry. Go. Buenas noches.
Buenas noches.
Wait, when will I see you?
Tomorrow.
I work at the bridal shop. Come there.
At sundown?
Yes. Good night.
Good night.
Tony!
Shh.
Come to the back door.
See.
Tony? What does Tony stand for?
Anton.
Te adoro, Anton.
Te adoro, Maria.
Good night, good night. Sleep well, and when you dream, dream of me.
Zach Meeker and Alyssa White as Tony and Maria from West Side Story Symphony Concert, presented by Raleigh Little Theater in collaboration with the Raleigh Symphony Orchestra. And I'm talking about it with State of Things producer Dana Terry, who is sharing her favorite programs of the year. You also booked Grammy-winning baritone Lucas Meacham on the show, a North Carolina native, went to Appalachian State, a karaoke singer who turned that passion into a career in opera, only in North Carolina.
Frank, this scared me so much. I mean, let's face it, opera is an acquired taste. Not everyone appreciates it, but I feel like Lucas Meacham started with something that even the biggest Looney Tune fan could appreciate.
Figaro, 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 Figaro.
That's a clip from baritone Lucas Meacham singing the end of Largo al Factotum from The Barber of Seville. And I'm talking about that with State of Things producer Dana Terry. So you see, it didn't hurt. That's nice. It's good stuff.
I love it. He is a North Carolina native. And Frank, people don't realize this, okay? This is a semi-small booth. And so my question for you is that here's this huge man with this huge voice that is used to filling arenas, and he's like booming in front of you. What was that experience like for you?
What was amazing was how perfectly he could modulate his tone. And I asked Robin Copley, our engineer, about it because I really wanted to see what was happening on the screen. I had a feeling that there was not a lot of peaks and valleys, even though you could hear the dynamics changing. A well-trained voice will not have these giant peaks and valleys, and that was exactly what happened on the screen. You look at it, and it's absolute perfection, and you could hear it and feel it. And feel it. That's the other thing. You can actually feel it in your chest. What an experience.
And Lucas closed the show with his signature karaoke piece. His wife, Irina, was on piano, and he also played harmonica. I think you'll recognize this, too.
It's a pretty good crowd for a Friday, and Frank Statio's giving me a smile, 'cause he knows that it's me they've been coming to see, to forget about life for a while. And the piano, it sounds like a carnival, and the microphone smells like a beer, and they sit at the bar and put bread in my jar and say, "Man, what are you doing here?" Oh, la 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 di di da. La la di di da da da. Sing us a song, you're the piano man. Sing us a song tonight, for we're all in the mood for a melody, and you've got us feeling all right.
Baritone Lucas Meacham. We should probably spend the full hour with him next year, and we can share his story about going from rural North Carolina to winning a Grammy. In August, my dear friend Howard L. Kraft did a 5-day limited run of his tribute to Nina Simone, a one-woman show called No Fear and Blues Long Gone, Nina Simone. This is a pretty cool show.
Yolanda Rabin plays Nina Simone. She is amazing. In this clip, she talks about Nina Simone's impact on her work. Writer Howard L. Kraft talks about the evolution of the show. Let's listen.
She is one of my very first idols and an example for me on the importance of storytelling through music, through the lyrics that you choose to sing, and just her life story, what to do and what not to do. She's like one of those unsung heroes that you just watch and you learn from what
you
know.
What's interesting is she's sort of half sung. I mean, the problem is you think you know, and then you hear, you know, oh, she was trained as a concert pianist, and oh, you know, she doesn't get into Curtis, and and all those little side things. You think you know her as an activist, you think you know her as a jazz singer, and then there's pop, and then
exactly,
just kind of like opens up. So, but and this show as well, because the two of you have been working on this since 2012, right? Is that right?
Yeah, 2012, and then we kind of took a little break, a hiatus for 7 years, and we are back now.
Back now with 13 songs in here.
Yeah, with 13 songs. As far as the monologues and the story, we basically had that from the first run. But, of course, you know, it's been updated, and I'm a better writer now, I hope, than I was 7 years ago.
He is.
I was able to tighten up some things. But the major difference here is that we do have these 13 songs where before, you know, we were just able to do snippets because of rights and, you know, all that. But now we can give a full breath. Well, I can't say a full breath. We can give an attempt at a breath of her work. Mm-hmm. You know, I say oftentimes that Prince reminds me of Nina Simone in the fact that you could have five people in a room and they can all like Prince and all like five different types of Prince's music.
Yeah.
And Nina Simone has so many different genres that she does and styles that she does that one of the things we wanted to do with the music is also try to tell her story through her different genres as they move up in time and she changes from jazz standards to pops to folk and activist songs.
That makes it tricky, even if you have 13 songs to choose from. Like, which 13? Because, like you said, somebody's going to say, how come you didn't include
them?
Always.
Yeah, well, we got the answer to that, you know. we didn't say 13 is a magic number, you know.
Yeah.
Some people said yes, and some people said too much.
That's exactly right.
Yolanda, maybe you can do a scene for us and give us a sense of what this is all about, will you?
Sure. I came to this world, Eunice Wayman, a skinny, naive black girl from Tryon, North Carolina, and I miss Eunice. Really, I do. But I wouldn't want to be Eunice again for anything in this world or the world beyond's, darling. She was sheltered, locked away in many ways like that cage bird. She had no time for mud pies or dolls. She was a child prodigy. She began playing the piano at 4. She had the audacity to dream of one day being the first black classical pianist. Her merry-go-round, her jump ropes, was the piano. And those ivory keys that little Eunice learned to tickle ever so lightly had her believing that her talent would open every door she'd come to. She got into Juilliard, did very well, and then she applied to the Curtis Institute of Music. Bless her heart.
Jazz singer and actress Yolanda Rabin as Nina Simone, one-woman show called No Fear and Blues Long Gone, Nina Simone. Man, so did you have to make a decision going in? Because, I mean, I heard Nina Simone in that, but you got to decide, am I going to do Nina or am I going to kind of go the other way?
And yes, as an actor, it is very important that you don't fall in the realm of imitation.
Yeah.
And also you keep some sense of yourself, because when you're doing a role like Nina Simone, you want to be true to who she is, but to really immerse yourself into Nina Simone, you could possibly lose yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I had to make that decision, especially now, 7 years from the first time we did it, to make certain decisions. And I say that because the first time we did it, I would come home and my kids would say, Mommy, come back, Mommy. You're not Nina.
Recording artist Yolanda Rabun and writer Howard L. Kraft talking about their work on Nina Simone's one-woman show, No Fear and Blues Long Gone. Dana Terry loved that in 2019. We're going over her favorites in the past year. And I have to admit, you are the only, I think, at this moment anyway, the only producer who manages to bring superheroes to the show every single year and every chance you get.
Really. Well, I mean, it's a big year for superheroes, Frank.
How can we miss?
Marvel's, we didn't miss anything. I made sure of it. Avengers Endgame. The new Joker movie came out, so I did this story about the superhero craze this year. Plus, we dissected the new Joker movie. You know, Frank, we may not all listen to the same music. We may not read the same books, but collectively, most of us, we wind up at the movie theaters watching these films. So we even looked back and talked about the battle between Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, the two men behind the genius of Marvel. Frank, this was John Morrow, the interview with John Morrow. He's publisher of Tomorrow's Publishing, and his book was called Kirby and Lee, Stuff Said.
They actually had this argument in public almost by accident. We've got a 1987 radio interview with Jack Kirby that ends with Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. I think this was Jack Kirby's birthday, right?
It was his 70th birthday. It was a New York radio station, and they were interviewing Kirby, and Stan surprised the announcer by calling in to wish Jack a happy birthday.
Then this happens.
I'll say this. Every word of dialogue in those scripts was mine.
I don't want to...
Every story.
I can tell you that I wrote a few lines myself above every...
Yes, I've seen those.
They weren't printed in the book.
All right, look, both of you, hey, kids, both of you guys.
Jack isn't wrong by his own lights, because Jack, answer me truthfully.
I wasn't allowed to write.
Did you ever read one of the stories after it was finished? I don't think you did. I don't think you ever read one of my stories. I think you were always busy drawing the next one. You never read the book when it was finished.
Dialogue, Stanley.
Huh?
Let me get in there with him.
Professor, to my own dialogue. And that I think that's the way people are. So whatever was written in them it was the action I was interested in.
I know, and I really think, and look, Jack, nobody has more respect for you than I do, and you know that, but I don't think you ever felt that the dialogue was that important. And I think you felt, well, it doesn't matter. Anybody can put the dialogue in. It's what I'm drawing that matters. And maybe you're right. I don't agree with it, but maybe you're right.
All right, there's a little back and forth between Stan Lee and Jack Kirby from a 1987 radio interview. So just very briefly, what did you learn in doing all this? Because people were sort of roughly aware of this. Maybe my big question is, are the fans of Marvel, do they want to know about this fight, or are they mad at you for writing this
book? Stan Lee's really fervent, hardcore fans. They're a little bit angry. I think Kirby's really hardcore, fervent fans are a little bit angry that I didn't go further with this book and make it all slanted toward Kirby.
That's a clip of John Morrow, publisher of Tomorrow's Publishing, talking about the book that highlights the relationship between the men who helped create the superheroes that we know and love today. And I'm talking about that with State of Things producer Dana Terry, who's sharing her favorite segments this year.
I mean, have you ever heard a more intense discussion about comic books ever?
Yeah, well, I mean, their relationship is the stuff of that's a kind of a superhero dynamic that all by itself, as people debate and struggle over who wrote what and who's responsible for what.
I think hearing some of the behind the scenes of what's happening and how these, you know, characters came to be, it was kind of fun to me. I enjoyed it.
It's been a great year and a great year ahead, no doubt. What do you have queued up?
Oh, I have this book right here that I'll pass off to you. You can read it during the holidays. Mm-hmm. Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. Got this fella booked.
I'll do it when I come back. Hand me the book.
Here's the book.
And I'll read it over Christmas.
Also, we're going to talk to a local doctor who consults a bunch of Hollywood TV shows, helps them make these medical shows look more realistic. He's a neurosurgeon, Orrin Gottfried, so that's going to be fun. Bring a little Hollywood to North Carolina.
All right, you got me. I'm convinced. I'll come back.
All right, you better.
Dana Terry. Producer Dana Terry on the state of things, one of the people who makes this show, if you think so, so great. It's because of Dana and all of her pals. Here are her pals: Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley's our technical director, and North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.